This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me on the line from the studios of Public Radio Tulsa is Professor Robert Jackson of the English Department at the University of Tulsa. He's been interested in regional culture and regional studies for quite a while, but he has a new book out, Fade In, Crossroads, A History of the Southern Cinema. And Bob, welcome to the Journal.
Thanks for having me, Walter. It's great to be here.
What brought you to the topic of the cinema?
I've always been a movie buff. I started watching films when I was a kid. And as I got older and began to think about a career as a writer and an academic, it was sort of late in the game when I really began to realize that I had accumulated a lot of knowledge about film history. So I slowly started to work that into what I was already doing on literary studies and history. And by that point, it became clear to me that I might be able to produce some work of the sort that eventually made it into this book that really kind of triangulates these three fields of history, literature, and film and media studies. So, you know, I was surprised that nobody had spent as much time or attention on the subject. But it's really quite a tough thing to do because there's so much information from so many different disciplines that has to be synthesized.
Kip Campbell did early work on the South and film, but that was almost 25, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. There hadn't been a whole lot done, which really is amazing since, as you point out, the South and Hollywood kind of fell in love together from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's right. It seems obvious when you finished writing a book that this topic should have existed a long time before it did, but there are some good reasons that it didn't happen. The early cinema really has been associated with cities in the North, especially with New York, from its beginnings, and early cinema audiences were always kind of imagined to be immigrant audiences, you know. So the standard story was that Jewish, you know, moviegoers on the Lower East Side of Manhattan saw Charlie Chaplin films, and this was sort of part of the process of how they became American. And that is a big part of early film history. But I started asking questions about the people who lived out in the country and the people who lived outside of the Northeast. You know, commercial cinema really dates to about 1895, and that's only one generation after the Civil War. So what might it have been like for former slaves 30 years later to see films for the first time, or for farmers or other, you know, people outside of cities, as most Americans were in those days, to be encountering motion pictures for the first time? And once I started asking those questions, it was kind of like an avalanche, because the contributions of Southerners to the technology and the business history and the proliferation of the industry were really remarkably strong, and they were there from the beginning.
That's what I found especially interesting. I mean, I knew of some folks who were very much early on involved with the film industry and even later on, but I had no idea that there was a film community in Jacksonville, Florida. And I noticed early on in your opening chapter, you struggle, like a lot of us who have studied the American South, trying to draw a geographical boundary upon what is Southern.
That's right. You know, I grew up in the St. Louis area, out in the country outside of St. Louis, Missouri, and really never considered myself to be a Southerner in the same way that people farther south generally do. And that was kind of the spark of thinking about region and regional identity for me when I was in graduate school.
But what about folks who lived in rural Missouri outside of St. Louis? I mean, St. Louis is on the river, more cosmopolitan. Missouri, as you point out, a slave state, sent folks to fight in both sides. So is it Southern?
That's the question. That's really the question. And I think that answer probably does change very locally. You know, you can go just a few miles from where I grew up, which was about 30 miles away from St. Louis, and people will pronounce the name of the state in both ways that you just did, Missouri and Missouri. And that tells you a lot right there. I think African Americans have had different definitions of what it means to be Southern, and certainly many of the black migrants to cities like St. Louis have ongoing and complicated relationships to the South. That's a big part of the challenge of defining what's Southern. And, you know, and in the opening section of the book, I talk about the South Side of Chicago, which had a massive influx of African American migrants from the South on such a scale that Southern folkways and religion and all kinds of other cultural and economic patterns took hold there on a massive scale. But certainly those people would not have considered themselves to be Southerners, or that, you know, the South Side of Chicago was the South in anything resembling, you know, the Mississippi or Memphis that they had come from. So the real question for me has to do with the way that we understand and remember Southern history, and the kind of selectiveness that we use in defining what it means to be Southern. You know, we have these current debates about Confederate monuments and memorials and Civil War memory and all this stuff that's going on in the news. And, you know, one of the things that I often ask myself about those sorts of things is how complete, how comprehensive is the memory of the South? You know, the Southern experience goes back well before European settlers, thousands of years. You know, if we really want to think about the South in a holistic way that is true to its historical lived experience, the natural world, and all the patterns of human development, we have to constantly push ourselves to think more expansively about more groups of people. And also, I think that the way that people have migrated, especially in the 20th century, out of the South, taking culture to places like St. Louis and Chicago, and especially, as I discuss in the book, to Los Angeles, where they contributed to the development of the Hollywood studio system in a really substantial way. This is an aspect of Southern history that goes beyond any geographic borders. So I'm a little bit less interested in geography in that sense, right? Trying to define whether or not Missouri counts as a Southern state or whatever, than in tracking the way that Southerners, black and white Southerners, moved around and took their experiences with them, whether it's Okies from Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas moving out west, or African-American migrants to places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, who get involved in the film industry in different ways out there.
The Great Migration, which in terms of actually South Carolina was both black and white up until World War II, you had expatriate South Carolina communities in places like Pittsburgh and Buffalo being larger than many towns in the state of South Carolina.
That's right. And that's certainly the case in Los Angeles, too. Texas and Oklahoma, the Western South and Louisiana exported more people out west, I think probably for obvious reasons, just geographically it's a little easier access. And people from the Carolinas are going to be ending up in Pennsylvania and New York State. Part of the particular interest in African-American culture for me has to do with these networks of kinship and relationships that are extremely tight. People who migrated out of the South didn't just go one way, right? And as we know, the black migration in particular has been reversed in the last few decades, so that there are a lot of African-American folks who several generations ago left the South and have been returning. And that sort of back and forth movement interests me very much, especially culturally, because when you think about the way that literary texts are produced, imaginative literature, poetry or film, or right, these cultural traditions that depend upon imagination so much, it's not as if you can simply go somewhere and leave your past behind. It's much more the case that people are producing art that really reflects the sum total of their lived experience. And I think particularly in African-American film, there's a great sense of connection between the South and other parts of the country. I've found that to be stronger for them as a group than I have for non-African-American filmmakers. And it's really a remarkable tradition because it's now basically 100 years long, independent black filmmaking. So you can begin with early silent filmmakers like Oscar Micheaux, who was deeply interested in what was happening down South, even though he was based in Chicago and New York for most of his career, all the way up to, you know, more recent filmmakers like Charles Burnett, who's based in L.A., or even someone like Spike Lee, who grew up in New York and went to college in Atlanta, has some Southern relatives, and really moves around quite widely when he's producing his stuff. So he's got films that are set in the South, and he's got films that are set in New York and Chicago. And this is an aspect of, you know, the film tradition that I think lends itself particularly to interesting and more creative ways of imagining what the South actually is. Certainly more interesting than the kind of this much more traditional sense of geographic limitation might do.
Early on, you talked about people thought that the cinema was designed for the immigrant communities of Chicago or New York or what have you. I think our listeners might be interested in what kind of films were being produced. They were really very short. There were things like fight films. If you could develop those themes a little bit.
Well, it's going to change very rapidly. The very earliest films in the late 1890s are almost invariably single-shot films. They might be 10 seconds long, 30 seconds long, something like that. Something as simple as a woman dancing or the waves crashing on the beach or something like that. Really just recordings of movement that were designed to reveal how this new technology of the motion picture camera is distinct from still photography. And then in the first decade of the 20th century, about 1903 or so, with films like the first Uncle Tom's Cabin adaptation and The Great Train Robbery, films like this, where there's a beginning of narrative development. So really between 1903 and 1910, 1915 or so, this is the period in which story films are beginning to be produced in great numbers. And they're still quite short. One reel of film in those days might be maybe 15 minutes, usually something closer to 12. So people would go to the movies and watch short films. Maybe, you know, you could compare them to some of the cartoons, like Bugs Bunny cartoons or something that kids have watched, that kind of stuff. And it's really only in about 1915, with the production of the D.W. Griffith epic, The Birth of a Nation, which has everything to do with the South, that feature-length filmmaking of 2 hours or more begins. But certainly, yeah, those early films are as disparate and varied as you can imagine. Documentary films, and many of them with a kind of newsreel quality, and a lot of nonfiction, non-narrative films, films of parades, films of people gathering in social spaces, that kind of stuff. So it's easy for us to look back and see this stuff as being kind of uninteresting and boring. But at the time that it was being produced, I mean, it was really wildly innovative. And then around the world, in places like France, for example, the sense of creativity and imagination that went into some of these early experimental films was really wildly original.
Let's talk about the development. You know, everybody thinks about Edison and his studios in New Jersey. But this move to Jacksonville, which would you say that was the Hollywood at the turn of the 20th century? I mean, seemed to be so many companies moving down there for climate.
I think the people in Jacksonville would like to have that title. But it really was something quite unique. New York, up to World War I, really was still going to be the center of the industry. It's not really until World War I and maybe 1920 that Los Angeles emerges as the most important capital of American filmmaking. And New York had several problems. There were unions that filmmakers found difficult to work with. There was also a big dispute about who owned the technology, the cameras, and especially the exhibition equipment. And Edison and a handful of other producers put together essentially a kind of monopoly, a small handful of business owners who tried to control all of the technology and basically limit who could produce film. This was about 1908 or so.
Edison was pretty good at that, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. He didn't really care what was being filmed. This is the thing about Edison and film. He was far more interested in the machines themselves, the cameras, the projectors, and the exhibition equipment. So he was much more of a technology guy than he was interested in narrative film or nonfiction or any of the cultural dimensions. He really saw it from a much more commercial perspective. But part of the reason that Florida and other places outside of New York began to seem attractive to a lot of filmmakers was that they could get away from this gang of monopolists, basically, and they could go try to find some space where they weren't being spied upon. There was less surveillance and less harassment as they tried to produce some film. And then, you know, New York has four seasons in a way that a lot of parts of Florida do not. And so the idea of being able to film year-round was also a very attractive commercial thing. And people would go down to Florida and up and down the Atlantic coast. They would settle for weeks at a time at the beginning and then eventually longer and longer periods of time until really in the 1910s, Jacksonville had something like 30 or 40 film companies that were producing movies there, all kinds of stuff from animal films to adventure films. And we see a lot of Southern topics, films about plantation life, pirate films, films about, you know, the trade routes in the Caribbean, exotic films. We see a stronger African-American presence, usually in pretty derivative, stereotyped ways. But the scenery down there and the people who lived in and around Jacksonville became part of the industry then. So it was a series of different things that played into this, but Jacksonville really became the most important place for film production outside of New York for about a decade there. It really was only with the emergence of Los Angeles, which pretty quickly consolidated its.
Well, didn't some local opposition develop in Jacksonville? The whole question of whether films are moral or immoral, bad influence on youth.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, people who had lived in Jacksonville for their entire lives didn't particularly care for what were essentially theater troupes. I mean, these crazy people would show up and have their entirely non-Floridian lifestyles and take over the town. And they were staging car chases on public streets and producing films on Sundays when everybody should have been in church. There's already a kind of vigorous debate in Jacksonville at that point about vice activities, including prostitution. There was a mayor named Jett Bowden who actually supported the legalization of prostitution and a kind of sort of Las Vegas approach to Jacksonville's culture. So ongoing political disputes played into the debate about film, and movies were seen in many ways as just one step away from prostitution, which is a pretty time-bound way of looking at the cinema back in the progressive era. There are a lot of details. And then World War I's emergence, which made the United States a more powerful producer because everybody in Europe has to stop making films while they're fighting the war, especially in those early years of World War I. But it also isolated the United States a bit and eventually drew the United States into a much bigger global network of film that would limit the influence of Jacksonville.
Early on, as you point out, there were individual entrepreneurs. This is pre-World War I. The studio system has not yet taken over. And there were a number of African-American filmmakers during this time. You've already mentioned Michaud, but he actually goes later. But some of these were, as you point out, like newsreels, the woman who really started her incredible company based upon African-American cosmetics and the films that she took around to cities.
That's right. That was a woman named Annie Malone, and she had settled in St. Louis as a business person and developed this vast network of cosmetics franchises and produced films, basically what we now today would call industrial films. And these were probably films that demonstrated sort of training films for some of her employees, but probably some other things that showed what was happening in St. Louis at the home office, which was a pretty massive factory and a kind of college campus that really was central to this era, the early 20th century's black imagination of what middle class life was going to be like when more African Americans finally gained access to a middle class existence. So it was part of this kind of racial uplift mission. And it was also a very important process in which film was connected to political life and economics and business and social life in a really comprehensive way. Annie Malone's vision for what film might be able to do was a completely different thing than what we think of now when we think of the movies. You know, usually when you're talking to your friends about, well, should we go watch a movie? It's imagined simply as a sort of escapist entertainment, even when it's something that might be socially relevant, right? You go in the theater, you sit there for a couple hours, and hopefully it's a good film, right? But the possibilities for the medium that existed in these earlier decades, even coexisting and competing in some ways with the Hollywood tradition, could really be quite interesting and original. Another aspect of the book that really drew me in when I was working on it was trying to come to terms with the great variety of Southerners who had interesting ideas about how film could be used. Many of them working inside Hollywood's studios, but many more people in Jacksonville, people in North Carolina, people in Atlanta, and elsewhere. Who figured out different ways of using film for all kinds of social purposes. In this way, I think it really does become something that dovetails much more with Southern history as a broad category, because it's woven into the texture of daily life in the South for the first half of the 20th century.
All right, Bob, we need to pause a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Professor Bob Jackson from the University of Tulsa about Southerners and the development of the American film industry. Bob, World War I, we already have Birth of a Nation, which could be a topic for about 2 or 3 hours just on it.
That's right.
Just on it, on its own. I think it may be just let us spend a few minutes on it and then go on out to Hollywood and the development of the studio system and the distribution networks, which again were crucial, and the role that at least one Southerner played in that.
Sure, that's right. And when you talk about the production and release of The Birth of a Nation, which is the most notorious film of all time, and the development of the studio system in Hollywood, you're really talking about two things that happen simultaneously. The Birth of a Nation is a horribly racist film, and people should take a look at it simply to see just how particular this kind and really more than one kind of racism can be on display in a single film. It's really an epic about the heroism of the Ku Klux Klan, telling the story of the Civil War and especially the Reconstruction period after the war from the point of view of white Southerners who feel so victimized by what's happened to them that they are willing to create this terrorist organization and do everything they can to kill black people and take away any political rights that they might have in order to consolidate their own control of the society for the long term. So that's what's happening on the screen. But at the same time, this is a film that cost $100,000 to produce back in the day when that actually meant something. I mean, that was serious money. This was a major, major financial risk that would have destroyed everyone's career associated with it had it been a flop. And instead, it was so profitable that it turned many of the people who had invested in it and participated in it into the builders of the Hollywood system. Just one example of this is a man named Louis B. Mayer, who became the studio head at MGM Studios, which was the most successful and most Hollywood studio all the way up to, you know, the 1950s. Well, Mayer had been a theater distributor and exhibitor in New England, where he had lived in his early life. And when he learned about the initial premiere, these sort of pre-premiere screenings of The Birth of a Nation in Los Angeles, he arranged to have exclusive distribution rights for the film in his part of Massachusetts and made so much money on this film that he was able to really become one of the central players in the Hollywood system. And I use that just as an example for how people associated with the Birth of a Nation became central to the system for the long term. And this included film directors who were young, sort of proteges of the Birth of a Nation's director, D.W. Griffith, people like John Ford, who went on to a very long career as a director. He's mostly known for Westerns, but he was a great filmmaker across the board, and actors and actresses and, you know, others who had been in production on the film. So as the system emerges as a really the kind of the dominant industry in world cinema, we see the way that the Birth of a Nation and everything that it represents as a blockbuster, as an epic, and, you know, most unfortunately, as a purveyor of the kind of racial inequality that we associate with Jim Crow segregation. It did all of those things at the same time.
One of the major African-American protagonists was played by a white actor in blackface.
That's right. The black actors in the film are extras, but all of the speaking roles and the featured roles for white and black are played by white actors. So they'll be actors in blackface. And, you know, the most notorious lynching sequence in film history, which features a black Union soldier who chases a young white girl, and eventually she falls off a cliff and dies, and these Klansmen come and get him and kill him. That actor is white. His name is Walter Long, and he's playing that role in blackface. So again, that's just kind of a measure of how little the film actually dealt with historical accuracy. But it's really kind of a series of white fantasies and also white nightmares about what's happening to them in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, especially in the South, but not exclusively, and the way that race relations is going to play out in the period.
But white actors in blackface continued. Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson.
That's right.
I mean, that, what, late 20s, early 30s, that was still going on.
Oh, it went on long after that. I mean, this is something that really is going to last up into the 1950s and 60s. And Jolson and Cantor are famous blackface performers. But just about all, I mean, if you ever really did some research on this and took a look at the names of Hollywood actors who appeared in blackface at some point in their careers on screen, this list would include Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney. It would include Betty Grable. It would include Will Rogers. You know, many of the most important figures in the history of Hollywood were involved in it at one point or another, and in some cases extensively. Blackface minstrelsy is really, I refer to it in some places as the roots of American popular culture in the early 19th century. And this is not a Southern thing. I mean, it was really derived in immigrant communities in places like New York as a sort of fantasy or caricature of what Southern black existence might be like. But, you know, this is central to American popular music and the stage. And so it really just quite naturally became part of film history when film arrived on the scene around the turn of the century.
All right, we've got the studio system now, but distribution, Mr. Mayer had New York locked up. But Mr. Lynch, and I think he was from Tennessee.
He was actually from Asheville, North Carolina originally.
Okay.
But this is a man named Stephen Lynch who had grown up. He had really a colorful life. He was a professional baseball player early on and seemingly a very charismatic, athletic, outgoing young businessman who got involved in theater management. I think he probably started as an usher or something like that in a small theater in Asheville, North Carolina. And pretty quickly began to accumulate what became a huge theater chain, basically all the way from the Carolinas out to Texas. Hundreds of theaters came under his control by all means. I mean, he employed some pretty rough characters who would go and essentially threaten theater owners who were independent and say, we're going to, I don't know what, you know, if they were going to bomb their theaters or if they were going to destroy them or vandalize them, but they would make it clear that it was very important for those owners to sell their theaters to Mr. Lynch immediately. And in most cases, they were successful. Another tactic, and this is sort of the same sort of thing that people like John D. Rockefeller would do in the oil business, would be to open up a competing theater across the street and try to drive people out of business as independents that way. And Lynch's chain of theaters was eventually purchased by Adolph Zukor, who was the builder of the Paramount empire. So Paramount Studios was really the dominant exhibitor in the South. Because it had acquired all of these theaters across the entire region, most of which had at one time or another been independent. And so we see the way that the South and this figure, Stephen A. Lynch, plays into the film history beyond the region by demonstrating that this model of accumulation of theaters was really a viable part of the business. And this would be the case all the way up into the 1940s, until the Supreme Court in 1948 required them to divest their holdings so that they could no longer have a monopoly on theater ownership, which they eventually did.
A lot of eye-opening information in your book, but when Lynch sold his chain to Paramount, he got $5.7 million, which in the late 1920s was a huge fortune. But he stayed with Paramount, right?
He did. He settled in Florida, and he made his money before the Depression hit. So he really kind of rode out the Depression in very comfortable circumstances, didn't lose his money in the crash. And he became a kind of elder statesman who would come back and advise the company on management strategy and that kind of thing. And there were also people, you know, I mean, it's not just one guy. There's an entire organization that he built that produced many of the people who would contribute to the management of the studio for a long time, including a man from Georgia named Frank Freeman, who became really the number two guy at Paramount all the way up into the 1960s.
We touched on it briefly, and that was the representation of African Americans in film, whether it was the blackface, but also the caricature, the Stepin Fetchit, the Billy Bojangles, that kind of thing. That image of black men and women continued well into the 1960s.
Yeah, it's really only the civil rights movement that eventually creates the kind of pressure on the system to begin to abandon some of those images. There are moments, and there are individual figures, certainly in the 1950s, figures like Sidney Poitier began to emerge, you know, and he wasn't interested in, you know, replicating those racial stereotypes on screen. And some women actors like Lena Horne, who was around really in the 40s in Hollywood, until she simply got tired of dealing with the headaches that came with trying to balance her racial identity with the demands of a fundamentally racist and segregated movie studio.
Wasn't she actually edited out of films distributed?
Yes, she was. She was an innovator, and this was taken especially by the black press and by a lot of interested parties who were eager to see more rounded and humane portrayals of black life on the screen as a great advance. But when she was signed by MGM, she had been known as a great cabaret performer, a great singer before this. But she actually negotiated into her contract, which was a 7-year contract with MGM, that she would never wear a bandana on screen and that she would never be required to play a domestic servant. Which really severely limited the types of roles available to an African-American woman in Hollywood. People that we remember, black women that we remember from Hollywood in these days, are almost invariably domestic servants. People like, you know, the famous Hattie McDaniel from Gone with the Wind playing the role of Mammy, right? Those are really the extent of African-American women's opportunities in Hollywood. So on the one hand, Lena Horne became a great innovator and a breaker of tradition by being portrayed as a beautiful woman, right, in her own right, somebody with a talent that did not have to be pinned to the plantation or to some other derivative racist setting. But at the same time, it became clear pretty quickly that movie exhibitors, and again, the South is leading the way. We're not eager to screen films that had roles like the ones that Lena Horne was eager to play. So the compromise that emerged was that she would be featured for a couple of sequences, often just as a singer, a torch singer, somebody singing a couple of songs in a musical or in a non-musical or something like that. And they would be filmed and edited in such a way that they could be removed so that the film could still be exhibited in a place like Memphis, which had the most notorious censorship practices in the country. And they could still make a few bucks on the film. And then the same film could be shown in Los Angeles or somewhere else in its entirety. So it's a really paradoxical kind of compromise that they started to make
there. All right. Didn't Lena Horne basically give up on Hollywood when she didn't get the role she really wanted and it went to Ava Gardner?
You're talking about a production of Showboat that was made in 1951, and that is the case. She did want that role of this mixed-race character who was going to be a great singer. And it would have, I think, been probably a perfect role for her. There is some debate among historians about whether or not she was actually ever considered seriously for this role. So there are other things that came into play. But in any case, she was disappointed not to receive it. And I don't know if that was the thing that made her leave Hollywood. But I think probably more accurately, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. Because she had been so disenchanted and disillusioned by really what amounted to a fundamentally segregated workplace. And she had other things. She really loved New York and wasn't ever that comfortable in Los Angeles. So she was homesick. She had family things going on that played into her decision. And she was also becoming more conscious of a desire to be involved in progressive racial politics in the early 50s. She wanted to be more involved, as she would be eventually, in the civil rights movement. And I think all of these things kind of came to a head there in the early 50s. And that production of Showboat was sort of the opportunity for her to walk away.
Yeah. All right, Bob, not only were African Americans given minor roles, but didn't Hollywood actually, beginning in the 1930s, kind of censor itself on how the South might be represented in film? Imitation of Life perhaps being an exception, but the old South in capital letters was, whether it's Gone with the Wind, So Red the Rose, which of course didn't do well, Jezebel, the list is almost endless.
That's right, yeah. Well, the 30s is an interesting period to think about in terms of Southern film because it's the Depression and this sort of economic crisis that everyone is deeply worried about and you know, fretful over becomes a kind of driving force in Hollywood for portrayals of American life. So what better place to look for an interest in how to deal with an economic crisis than the South, right, which had been ravaged and right, the devastation to its economy that took place as a result of the Civil War. So thinking about the Reconstruction period and then the modern South with sharecropping and the chain gang system of prisons and all sorts of other aspects of Southern life that became well known nationally and kind of representative of what we associated with the South. Appalachian stereotypes, hillbilly stereotypes, right? White trash stereotypes, things like that. These things all really emerged with greater force in the 1930s because the rest of the country was thinking about the Depression. So in some ways, a movie like Gone with the Wind, which is set in the Civil War era, is really a story about the Great Depression, right? It's a story about this young woman's struggle to make ends meet and her insistence, even to the point where she degrades herself, right, and becomes a very corrupt figure in order to get wealthy at the expense of everyone else. But it's a kind of parable for American aspiration and American fantasy during the Great Depression period. And this becomes one way that the South is portrayed. It's interesting to think about the South on film across a number of periods because after the Depression is over, say in the 1940s when the war economy really helps people get back up into the middle class again, those images become passé and it's another set of images about the South that becomes important. And then again in the 1950s and 60s as the Civil Rights era really heats up, we see all kinds of different portrayals of Southern life. So what the big lesson seems to be here is that movies about the Old South, or any aspect of the South, but especially about the Old South, are never really about history. They're really not particularly interested in the broad lived experience of Southerners at any point in the past. What they're really interested in is using some type of skewed memory in order to make a statement about the present day. And that's really the way that American film particularly has approached history, whether it's Southern history or any aspect of U.S. history. And I think that this is really a vital thing that we need to keep in mind as we think about the way that film shapes our attitudes towards the past. It's never really about the past. It's always about the present.
Well, we've talked about films that really changed attitudes, Birth of a Nation, Gone with the Wind. What are a couple others you might put in a different category, like Intruder in the Dust, for example? Imitation of Life was made 4 or 5 times. And by the way, when I was growing up, my parents wouldn't let me go see Imitation of Life.
The 1959 version of Imitation of Life?
Yeah.
Controversial film. I mean, it's a very challenging movie. That movie was originally shot in 1934. And I go back and forth because I think both productions, the 34 version and the 59 version, have a lot to offer. They're both very interesting movies. And if your listeners haven't ever heard of the film before, it's basically the story of two women who are single mothers. One of them is white and one of them is black. And they sort of throw their lot in together and raise their daughters together. And it becomes a kind of story of mother-daughter relationships, but also it's about the complexity that has emerged in modern race relations, particularly for mixed race children, because the black woman's daughter has very light skin, and there's a sort of a question of whether or not she's going to be able to pass into white culture, dealing with all the psychological implications of that sort of thing. So you can imagine in 1934, at the height of the Jim Crow era, just how incendiary a film like that might be. But even in the late 50s, as you're describing here in your own experience, this is pretty hot material. And
I grew up in Mobile, Alabama. There was one theater that African Americans could go to. They could go to the Sanger, which had a second balcony. So they really were at the very top of the theater. But when Imitation of Life came, it was at a neighborhood theater, and I said I wanted to go, and I would have been 15 at the time. My parents said, nope, can't go see it.
Yeah. Well, it's in a way, it's almost surprising that that film was even screened down there in 1959. But it was also a movie that got really sort of an uneven reception. There were parts of the South that really celebrated the movie. Patrons, white people seemed to love it. Black people were receptive to it too. And then in other places that, you know, it really just terrified people, even to sort of think about progressive race relations in even the slightest of open-minded ways. So there's a lot of anxiety that's really discernible there. Yeah.
Okay, Bob, I'm going to put you on the spot. What is your favorite, for whatever reason, film about the South prior to 1960?
Prior to 1960? That's a question that I get a good deal because, you know, I've spent so much time talking about movies like The Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, which have done so much damage. There are some films from the beginning of the medium that I do think are really quite constructive and interesting. Coming out of the Hollywood tradition, I think that one of the best films that has ever been made about Southern culture is a movie called The Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum. It was made in 1955, and it was directed by Charles Laughton, and the only film that Laughton ever directed. And it's a kind of horror movie, pretty mild by the standards of contemporary horror movies, but it's a very gothic story about a preacher who is on the hunt for two small children who have some money that he thinks he should have. So it's got this sort of Grimm's fairy tale element to it. And it's one of the most beautiful films just in terms of the visual imagery on the screen. You could watch it with the sound turned off and just be blown away by the beauty of the film. But I think it gets a lot of the things about the modern South right. It is a story about religious fervor and kind of evangelical faith that has run amok. It's a story about Southern communities, and it's really not particularly a story about race. It's set in Appalachia, so it's mainly a white story. But the things that it has to say about how ordinary people live their lives and the communities that they're in was really quite remarkable. It was based on a screenplay that James Agee, the great writer from Tennessee, produced towards the end of his life. And I give Agee a great deal of the credit because he was a very thoughtful film goer and film critic in his earlier years, and a great writer, great literary figure in his own right. The other thing that I'd recommend is a body of work by a North Carolina filmmaker who it would be unknown in Hollywood. And his name was H. Lee Waters. And this is a man who was not really interested in narrative film, but he produced something like 118 documentaries about Southern life that would basically portray the people on the street in any given community, mostly in the Piedmont area, some in South Carolina, mostly in North Carolina. And they're just absolutely breathtaking films. By far the best record of Southern documentary life that we have. And he made those films in the late 30s and early 40s. Many of them are available on YouTube, and the collection, most of the collection, is archived at Duke University and the libraries there. So people can actually kind of hunt around for stuff on the
I've seen several of his South Carolina community studies, and yes, they are fantastic. Everyday life in those communities. I asked you for your favorite movie. Now, if you're looking at your pantheon of influential Southerners in the film industry, regardless of whether they were actor, director, distributor, what have you, can you give me four or five folks that you would want our listeners to remember?
Well, I think that it really comes down ultimately to one man who is by far the most influential figure in both the Southern film tradition and probably the entire American film tradition, and that is D.W. Griffith, who was the director and producer of the Birth of a Nation in 1915. He, in many ways, was the most innovative figure in the silent period. He produced something like 500 films, most of them very short. He gradually got into longer filmmaking and was very successful at that for a few years. And not all of his stuff was about the South. He made films on every topic. But he was really the guy who was able to point the way to what the Hollywood studio system was going to be like in producing entertainment film and in doing things with narrative, with editing, with melodrama and other genres that would be very interesting. Just a towering figure in the field. And because he was so influential, he became a kind of father figure or a mentor figure for all kinds of other filmmakers. And I mentioned John Ford earlier, who was from the coast of Maine. He's certainly not a Southerner, but he approached the South in a lot of really sensitive ways that many native-born Southerners never actually did. So Griffith is a crucial figure. There's also Cecil B. DeMille, who was another big, kind of one of the titans of the Hollywood industry for all these years. And he had family roots in North Carolina, spent time there as a child, and also grew up partly farther north in New Jersey before coming out west. But he really had a deep feeling for Southern life, too, and several generations of his family had been from the South before him. So if you're looking at really influential major figures in the industry, he would be on that list, too. There's also a filmmaker from the southern coast of Texas named King Vidor, who I've always found a fascinating figure. And he got into film very young, moved out to California, and would sort of go back and forth as a director, mostly at MGM in the early days, and then kind of more independently later on. He would make films about the South, and he would make films about other topics too. And a couple of his films from the 1920s, particularly The Big Parade from 1925, which is a World War I story, and then a film called The Crowd from 1928, which is really the story of just an anonymous guy living in a very crowded New York setting in the 1920s.
These are some of the greatest films ever made. And Vider would continue to have a really nice career for many years.
Your book ends with World War II. These people set the stage, so to speak, for the contemporary cinema. Is there any influence, or has Hollywood gone somewhere else?
I think there's a lot of influence, and I think that the legacy that the pre-1950 American cinema still has on contemporary American life is quite considerable. Many of the big problems and questions that we continue to have about race and media, about the relationships between the past and the present, about regional identity and the place of the South in the United States and the world, kind of more broadly, all of these things continue to be vital questions.
Professor Robert Jackson of the English Department at the University of Tulsa, delighted you could be with us today on The Journal.
It's been a pleasure.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. I learned an awful lot about the early history of the cinema, and especially the impact of Southerners on the development of Hollywood's golden age, whether it was actors, directors, producers, or early Hollywood moguls. It's a fascinating story, and not one that many folks know about today. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.